You're listening to Asians Represent, a series on the One Shot Podcast Network. I'm your host, Daniel Kwan, and this episode is brought to you by our amazing supporters on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/AZNSrepresent for exclusive content, show notes, and more. Welcome, folks, back to Asians Represent. This is episode 69 of the podcast. So, episode 69 of the podcast, we hit a big milestone, although I think we're way past, I think we're well over 100 at this point. But in terms of our weird numbering system, this is episode 69 of the Asians Represent podcast. And this is kind of the start of a seasonal show that we're going to do called Homebrewing Asia, where each episode we talk about a particular part of Asia. I don't want to say Asian culture because there are multiple cultures within China. So we're looking at different geographic regions, talking about their histories and interesting sources of inspiration. And we are, of course, going to get the correct people to host and be guests for these. And so for this inaugural episode, we're talking about China. And the reason why we think this episode or this sort of format is important is because there is this idea that fantasy is neutral. This idea that, your fantasy worlds are not a reflection of reality, right? Don't get upset over Oriental Adventures. Don't get upset over Karatur, Rokugan, all of that stuff, because it's not real. But the thing is, like, fantasy worlds don't exist in a vacuum. And so for this series, we're going to explore how you can break the traditions of Western RPG design to create worlds that are inspired by different parts of Asia. I read a really interesting excerpt from a book called Race and Popular Fantasy Literature by Helen Young. And in it, there is a discussion about the habit of whiteness in fantasy. And it was such a simple yet concise an eloquent way of saying, like, talking about the problems of fantasy. And it's this reinforcement of whiteness and its dominance over the world. And so for this one, I have Jeremy and Agatha, who are officially, Agatha's always been, but so Jeremy and is joining Agatha and I officially as a full-on member of Asians Represent. Signed the contract. We're all part of the One Shot Network. Look at that. And so I'm really excited because, Jeremy, you've got some stuff that you're going to be doing on the podcast. Once you've kind of settled, you're kind of like world traveler right now, I guess. Yeah. State traveler.
State traveler, then world traveler. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've got some really good stuff ahead of us. And Agatha, this is like the first time you've been back on the show in like a while.
Yeah. I'm like still here, everyone.
Yeah, I'm still here. Like, you're on the Discord. You're doing all sorts of stuff. We unfortunately got a sad email before the start of this, and all three of us were just, like, really bummed out. A thing that all three of us worked on, worked really hard on, got canceled. So we can't talk about it, unfortunately. We got paid, and we got paid well. But what I care more about is the story we were going to tell with this thing.
I'm really sad,
but it happens.
Really sad about Redacted. Redacted was
really sad about Redacted and the redacted this
cool.
And redacted that we worked on. It was really cool. One day maybe we'll be able to talk about it. We'll maybe talk to the folks that we were collaborating with to see what happens. But yeah, we're sad about Redacted, but we're happy that we're all together again. So that said, I want to kind of start with a question that I know a lot of people will be kind of concerned about. Jeremy, you and I recently worked on a project together, like the first project that we've worked on together of this genre. You and I both worked on a miniatures war game. Mm-hmm. And in the truest fashion, it's a miniature war game that's being made in the UK. It is the closest to the root that you know we could get, called Margrave. And we'll link all of that in the show notes and our Patreon show notes as well. But Jeremy, you worked as a writer on this project, and I worked as a cultural consultant on it for the Asian Factions. And we had a lot of meetings with the creator, George of 3CL Studios, who is a joy to work with.
Yeah, George is good people.
Good people. And one of the things that came up in my conversations with George was this idea of authenticity. What does it mean, and is it possible to bring authenticity into a fantasy world? And so I wanted to sort of bring this question to the two of you. When you're playing your own home games, when you're writing fiction, when you're writing for a production or anything like that, what does it mean when, you know, the creator or you wants to bring authenticity to a project? Because I feel like that's going to be different because of all three of our actually very different lived experiences. Like, what is authenticity? Because that's something that people are going to struggle with when they're actually making their first TTRPG product or even trying to write something for their home game. Like, what does that mean to you when you say authenticity with regards to like our cultures? What do you think? It's a tough one.
I feel like it is very different depending on whether you are writing for your own consumption or if this is for a product that someone may be paying for or someone is consuming, not necessarily paying for. Because, like, if I want to write something for my own home group, it doesn't actually matter. Like, whatever I think is authentic and my group thinks is authentic is technically enough, you know? Like, and it can be as inaccurate as objectively can be, but it doesn't matter because the audience is cool with it. And you don't have the responsibility of good representation.
Yeah, I like that idea, or that point, I should say, about authenticity and responsibility, especially when it's a production. And you're totally right. Like, you don't have to worry if you're playing a home game. Or you do have to worry to a certain extent. Because if you are trying to represent another culture in your home game, authenticity can also tie into perpetuating harm, because you can be inauthentic in a way that causes harm to folks. What about you, Jeremy? What do you think?
I think, yeah, I agree very much with Agatha in that whether you're just making something for your home game or whether you're making something that will eventually be played by thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, those levels of responsibility are a little bit different. I think one thing that sort of guides me in both areas, because I've done both at this point, you know, freelanced and also just regularly run home games, is I do tend to follow the mantra of write about what I know, and so I look at the life experiences that I've had, living in Taiwan, living in Hong Kong, being a member of the mixed race Asian American diaspora, and trying to channel some of that into the game, whether that's, you know, like our home Pathfinder game, Daniel, where it's set in like Tianjin. It's set in Goka, which is like Singapore of Tianjin, but it's set in my version of Goka, which is very like influenced by my time in living in Hong Kong. Filled with all of the, you know, joys that I experienced there and all the crazy things that I love about Hong Kong, including, you know, Hong Kong cinema and stuff like that. And, you know, in the official project, like, we also, you know, Daniel and I also worked on the official Tianxia remake coming out beginning of next year. We really can't say much about that at this point, but I think, you know,
what
it's I think it's, you know, not not illegal to say that we both kind of try to pull from our own experiences, our own lived memories, whether they were of, you know, Asian legends that we grew up with, mythology, or our actual lived times, you know, in Asia or in Canada or whatnot. So I think kind of drawing upon your own personal experiences is always a great thing. And I feel like a lot of folks want to put like a foreign culture into their you know, for example, their D&D games in order to make something exotic or make something unusual. But sometimes you don't necessarily need to do that because your own experiences, your own knowledge about this world is deeply interesting. And I think if you inject that into, you know, whatever existing fantasy structure you're working in or whatever homebrew world you're making, you don't necessarily need to bring in like samurai from the so-called Far East or some sort of quote-unquote exotic culture to make things seem unusual and engaging.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, you make a really good point about like the use of like a cultural signifier, right? In that book, Race and Popular Fantasy Literature by Helen Young that I mentioned, the author notes that there are, and this is their quote, four interconnected elements of fantasy convention found in both sword and sorcery and high fantasy of the 1980s and 1990s, which contribute significantly its habit of whiteness. Cultural and physical geography, medievalism, the somatic markers of protagonists, and race logics, which connect physical and non-physical traits to biological descent. And that's something we still see today. I really, really like, and I hope our audience resonates with what you said about using, air quotes, foreign cultures as a way to make your world interesting. Because you're right. You don't need to put samurai in your medieval world to make it interesting or stand out, because medieval history itself is full of so much, right? It's deep. It's extremely varied. And you don't need to then sort of copy and paste another culture in there to make it interesting, to make it engaging for your audience, be it your home game or, you know, your production or for your product. No, I really like that. Foreign cultures don't make your world interesting.
So, Daniel,
what
is your answer to the question? Like, how do you make something authentic?
That's a really interesting one for me. Like, I've talked about this on the show a lot. Like, I think my answer would be very different 10 years ago than it would be now. Right, being of the diaspora, you know, I've talked about, you know, being kind of a child of two worlds, yet not really belonging to one of them, right? Like an outsider in North America, right? But also an outsider back in China, and not really truly belonging to either one. And so when you try to say, speak on your experiences in as a writer for like a production, for a product, you constantly struggle with this sort of imposter syndrome. Am I even allowed to write about China? There are those tweets that then say, like, there are people who say, oh, Daniel just pretends to be Asian. I mean, that's not the case. I am Asian. But am I allowed to write about my own culture if I only lived in China as an adult? And I didn't grow up there.
But that's a fascinating story.
Living in
China as an adult and dealing with the feelings of I am born from this culture, but I really don't understand it. I understand it through the lens of an adult who is trying to figure out what this means to me. Like that's super fascinating.
Yeah, and that's kind of showing up in my work, mm-hmm. right? And that kind of informs how I actually work as a writer. Because for me, I was really resistant, and I'm sure many Chinese, like Chinese Americans, Chinese Canadians also feel this way. I really regret being so resistant of my family's culture when I was younger because of this need to assimilate. Like, we talked about the model minority and all that, and how it has an effect on us. And I wouldn't have really gotten back into like learning about my own culture if I hadn't started traveling. Like, I was not really into learning about China until I went to Jordan, of all places, not even China. I remember my mom tells a story about when I first came home from Jordan, and they were like, well, what do you want to eat? What's the first meal you want to have back home? And I said, I just want like cha siu fan. I just want like barbecue pork and rice. And I remember my mom being like, what the fuck? Like, why? I was like, it's just what I want. And ever since then, you know, like, obviously, you know, I traveled to China a lot for like my doctoral work. I spent a lot of time there, and it had like a deep impact on me and my work. But I still struggle with that. I still struggle with like, oh, my Chinese is not as good. I can't write Chinese. Or, you know, when I get a request to work on a project and they want like the redacted project, I was like, they requested me, and I was like, I want Agatha on because there are things that Agatha can do that I can't, right? They're like on this redacted project that was basically this really cool historical Chinese horror thing that Agatha and I wrote. Agatha was really responsible for a lot of the really deep cultural indicators, like with the like language and naming. And I really focused on the Chinese diaspora part of it.
I just want to shout out, because I also consulted on this project a little bit, this redacted project. Agatha wrote redacted something project. In Chinese that was so dope that I couldn't read it very well because what she was writing was very, very literary. But I was like, in the comments, I was like, Agatha, just beautiful writing here. Well done. Like,
I want to say that what we did was just too good and they couldn't handle it.
Like, I think it was beyond what... Yeah, I can't say more. But it was very, very, very good.
Use the word beyond. It's not D&D beyond.
Yeah, not D&D beyond. Not D&D
it's
beyond.
It's not related D&D to beyond. That. Can you imagine? Scandal. No, it's not D&D beyond.
Yeah.
What we wrote was, like, extremely Chinese to the point where, like, the person who was kind of lead managing us was like, hey, I want to make sure that we do this justice, that you put like a translate, like how to say each name and everything.
Yeah. And
like,
they literally let us be
as Chinese as possible.
And then I came in and like double checked all this stuff, and now it's redacted. And yeah, redacted. So.
And actually, Jeremy, you've culturally consulted on two things that I've written.
Yes, I have. Yes.
Yeah. Redacted and redacted.
Yeah, redacted. And it's always very it's always a lot of fun because I mean what you write is already such a strong base, and it's more like they want to bring someone else in to basically be like, hey, what is this Asian guy writing? And I'm always like, this Asian guy is writing some pretty good stuff, and here's, you know, additional context, and I can't wait until this comes out.
If it comes out. But yeah, to answer your question, Agatha, like for me, like. My, like, what does authenticity mean? Like, I think you both said, like, you know, you're representing your truest self, right? You are writing about what you know. You are not using your culture or your experience as a way of even othering representations of yourself in your world, right? Making yourself the main character is very much how I try to be authentic in my writing. Like, I want to see myself, not literally Daniel Kwan, but I want to see myself in the characters. I want to see my experiences in the world. And this kind of leads into a question that I had sent you folks about, like, the idea of, like, the aesthetic. Like, how do you avoid drawing heavily on, like, these pre-existing cultural tropes? Like, before we started recording, we were, you know, making jokes about spirit points. And, like... key, like, how do you avoid drawing on like pre-existing cultural tropes when you're constructing fantasy worlds? How do you write about what you know? How do you bring yourself into a project, be it personal or professional? And I think authenticity is one part of it, right? Authenticity is both a conversation that you have to have internally with yourself. How am I representing my culture and my experience in this work? But also it's a conversation that you have with the person who hires you or your collaborators.
Yeah.
Is this a representation of yourself from the audience's eyes? And that's where I think I struggle. I think I really struggle about how my work is perceived mm-hmm. by others who identify with my own culture.
Right.
I definitely don't struggle with writing about myself and putting myself out there, but I definitely struggle with the external parts of authenticity. And that's how people are perceiving my work.
I think I'm thinking about it in terms of also this could be an interesting resource for people who are not kind of going back to the title of this episode, which is Homebrewing mm-hmm. Asia, Fantasy China. Like if someone is not from this background, like also how you would go about it. I feel like I think research is important. So for example, if you want to like homebrew China, like don't put ninjas in there. Like that kind of research is important. And I think once you have that, and that's, I don't want to just kind of like be like brushing that aside. Like you don't even need to do like actual really deep digging just to make sure that you kind of cover your bases of like, okay, these things that I want to include, is this actually like, if I want to do like Fantasy China, like, is this actually in this culture? And then once you have that down, I think one thing that would be really helpful to make a fantasy China, or even like just a fantasy world that is drawing from like a real world place that you're yeah. not a part of, is taking one aspect of like whatever culture or cultural practice that you can identify with, and then like, or you can find an equivalent for, and then presenting that information that way. So an example of that is like, let's say like, the civil exams, like in historical China, right? Like, that was a very big thing. That's basically how you had social mobility, if you can pass the civil exams and you can become like, you can join the courts and you become like a public servant, then you get a lot of like advantages. Like, you know, you don't have, like, depending on which level
it gives you status.
Yeah, and it gives you like tax breaks, like that kind of things like that. And like an equivalent of like how important that is. It's like sometimes hard, or maybe like for me to understand, because I don't, you know, I don't live in that world anymore. But like if I were to be like, okay, civil exams is what I want to put in my Fantasy China, and I'm like, it's basically like the SATs, but like
but worse.
But so much worse. But like if you were like so much better, question mark, because like if you pass the SATs, then your family like moves up or down like a tax bracket.
You have the extreme potential for social mobility.
Yeah.
With these exams. But I mean, you still see it now with the Chinese, basically the China's equivalent of the SATs.
Yeah. So this was a really bad example because I'm kind of coming up with it on the spot. But what I mean is just like finding something that you can really relate with, or that you and hopefully your audience. So it could be, again, like if it's just your table, like something that you all relate to, and then being like, so this, even though it is from a completely different culture or, and it's like exotic in some ways, but also there's something that really grounds it. Or so like things that are usually really relatable, like friendship or like, you know, needing to eat or like family stuff. Like usually those are the kind of things that I think are great for kind of bringing a sense of authenticity into an otherwise exotic setting. And also like things like, oh, this particular dish is a comfort food for this group of people. It's like us, you know, like when I want it, when I'm sad, I want to eat ice cream. This is like ice cream for them. Or, you know, like, I feel like that's kind of how you bring the humanity to it, because we are all so, we can only see from our own perspective. So you bring the humanity to other people by reflecting us on them, is kind of how I would go about it, answering your question from before, Daniel.
That was a really good answer, like bringing your own humanity into it. I really like that you were, you know, find something you can relate to, like almost like universal themes, things that are associated with being human that can help you kind of be your North Star, right? Kind of like a gateway, not only for your audience, but also a gateway for you as a creator.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that we did, we always do, like, I mean, we always start with this. We always say, before you even like dive in to any of these projects, before you dive into anything like this, the one thing you first have to do is ask yourself, why? Why are you doing this? Why are you using this culture, right? Maybe, yeah, you've already found that thing that you can relate to, right? But always first start with like, hey, why are you doing this in the first place? I think that should first be stated. Like, why are you doing this? Then, you know, all these other tips come into play, right? What is it that you relate to? Why this culture? If there is this universal theme that you can relate to, why haven't you picked your own culture or picked, you know, one that is closer to yours? Why have you picked something, in this case, Chinese?
Yeah, right? I think, like, related to that, remember to characterize things instead of characterizing things. You want to make characters, not caricatures. And that kind of relates to the whole idea of humanity. All of these things, these so-called foreign cultures, you know, they're humans living in those cultures, and you want to explore the humanity behind those things that you might initially just want to put in your game as cool. So an easy example is, you know, in fantasy games, there's always like there's the monk class. We always go back to talking about the monk, like the martial artist, who is clearly based on a Shaolin monk transplanted into the quasi-European setting that most fantasy games take place in. If you want to include a monk, like if you want to have a character that's basically Bruce Lee, okay, fine, like sure, you can do that. But you want to do a certain amount of research to humanize the Bruce Lee character. You don't just want to make him a character who just goes wata wata and like jumps around. You would want to go a little bit beyond that. Like if you want to actually have an NPC based off of Bruce Lee who practices something that looks like Jeet Kune Do, don't just have him yell out screaming or say things like be like water and stuff like that. Actually maybe investigate, you know, why did Bruce Lee develop Jeet Kune Do? What are the virtues behind that particular style of martial arts and the flexibility that it emphasized? You know, what does the be like water quote actually mean, and how might you describe that in a way to your table that is not just like a stereotypical like, oh, it's Bruce Lee, look, here he is, he's a monk. Like, how might you describe that to like the fighter who understands the importance of being flexible and adapting in combat, or the magic user who might have to spin spells out of nothingness and adapt to every ongoing situation? By doing that, you can inject the character with more humanity and also inject the culture that you're representing and the philosophy with much more depth, I think.
Yeah, and I think certainly is a very good point to make that, you know, while we are talking about homebrewing Asia and world building, we are also talking about characters, like the NPCs as well, because we don't want them to be like these stereotypes. We don't want to use these really easy indicators that, oh, this is Bruce Lee because they're wearing a yellow jumpsuit. No, they are more than that. Honestly, if I were to do a Bruce Lee character, I would honestly have it, like, you could go like, I mean, this is where D&D kind of falls short, right? I can do like a monk or a fighter, but I want them to have traveled because I want them to learn all of these different styles, right? And I want them to then maybe come back home, or maybe they're still in like the West, like Bruce Lee when he went to San Francisco, right? And maybe they're starting their own school and they have to, within this little Chinatown community, deal with, you know, a connection and a tradition, right? A connection to their home culture and how they are representing that in this new land, mm-hmm. I think is a really compelling, not only character, but also micro setting as well.
You can often zero in on, like, when trying to flesh out an NPC like this, like the Bruce Lee one, you can often zero in on their connections with family, their connections with their immediate surroundings, and mm-hmm. their connections with the, you know, the culture they were either born into or the one that they have adopted over time. And those are sort of good points to start out your fleshing out of this character.
Yeah, and I think this also relates to like a question that we had from one of our patrons and one of our Discord mods, Kat, who asked, do you think there's a sweet spot or a secret recipe to have your homebrew fantasy setting be both clearly evocative of the place or culture you're using as inspiration and uniquely its own thing? For example, like X percentage of X of elements brought over exactly as they really existed, a percentage of Y elements inspired by or like seen from a different perspective, or, you know, another percentage of Z of elements that are like completely made up. Like, is there a formula? The answer is no. There is no formula, right? I think to Jeremy's point of like characterize, not characterize, caricature.
It's tough to say. It's very tough to say.
It's tough to say. Characterize, not caricaturize, by humanizing the culture, by sort of making sure these characters are fully fleshed out, right, and not defined by stereotypes. Or Agatha's because Agatha, you're like a story gamer, right? You love story games, right? Like finding something that you as the creator and your table can relate to so that it essentially forces you to bring humanity into your game. And like Jeremy said, when you bring humanity into your game, into your creations, when you humanize the culture you're incorporating, you ultimately create something that is a little bit more authentic, right? Or at least your efforts are a lot more genuine and authentic. For me, a big one, and this is, I guess, from more technical perspective, because Kat's question was like technical, is you don't want to, in the context of China, depending on who you are from a scholarly perspective, like the first dynasty in China could either be the Xia dynasty if you're like a Western scholar, or if you're a Chinese scholar, like if you're a Chinese scholar, you'd say it's the Xia dynasty, which is like, you know, like 2000 BC or slightly later or earlier, or you could say it's the Shang dynasty at like 1600 BC, right? That was a really long time ago. And that was during the Bronze Age. And during the Bronze Age in China, their material culture, their customs, their languages, like, were fundamentally different from what you see in, like, Margrave, the game that Jeremy and I worked on, where we're looking at, like, Qing Dynasty and, like, Jin Dynasty, right? We're looking at, like, the Banner Clans. Like, they are two very, very different points in China's history. They're... Like, Agatha, you had put together, like, elements of Chinese culture to include in a setting. You kind of talked about material, like, cultural, like, celebrations, practice, right? Spiritual and linguistic. But on top of that, you want to situate your creation and your inspirations for your creation on a specific time period. Because you don't want to generalize an entire region of the world, say China, with its modern political boundaries. You don't want to generalize what is essentially, you know, over 4,000 years of dynastic history. Like, how do you do that? And my tip from like a technical perspective would be, like Agatha, you know, find something that resonates with you, but also find a specific time period that resonates with you. If you want to do something about war, The Three Kingdoms is very well documented. There is so much information out there about the material culture, the weapons, the politics, right? You could easily, you know, incorporate that into a fantasy setting. You could even do the Warring States, which is another sort of like bloody period in China's history where China was divided into all of these different kingdoms or states. My home game and the campaign setting that, you know, I'm writing, the one that we're probably going to use for Wandering Blades on Asians Represent, is inspired by the Yue state, which is a tiny little state in sort of like central eastern China around Zhejiang province. And they were very culturally distinct from a lot of the other states. They were the only state that had a tradition of sword smithing. They were the only ones who had a tradition of sword naming. And they had a poorly documented history because they were not the winners. Because after the Warring States, many people know the Yue state is not the one that unified all of China. It was the Qin. And so the Yue basically disappeared, and a lot of people don't know about them. And for me, I really liked that. I gravitated towards the swords. I gravitated towards the sword making. And so in my campaign setting, it's a sword culture where bladesmithing is the highest art form. And swordsmiths are more respected than some political officials because of their art. And swords are not only a symbol of your status, but also deeply connected to who you are and the mythic history of this land, which actually neighbors the land of our previous Dungeons and Dungeons campaign. So for me, I latched on to a particular period in China's history, the Warring States period. I narrowed it down to a particular geographic region. And then I happened to pick one that I not only really related to and really was interested in, but also one that was poorly documented. So to Kat's question about sort of like the recipe for your homebrew, I picked one that gave me a lot of freedom to make things up because there wasn't a lot of information to work with. And so I kind of went that route because I wanted to have more freedom and I wanted to basically take one ingredient, swords, and build on that. But there are no sort of like guns in the sense of like later Chinese history. There aren't sort of these state exams like Agatha, you were talking about. Their political system is very different. There is no emperor because the emperor didn't exist then. The emperor came after the Qin sort of unified all of China. So there is no emperor. So in mind, there are kings. And that's kind of the approach I'd take. That would be like the recommendation I give to folks who are doing any sort of homebrew world building based on a real life culture or based on a real life part of the world. It's narrow down your focus. Because if you don't narrow down your focus, you're just creating one giant stereotype of like, let's do Japan, samurais. Like there were parts of Japan's history where there were no samurai. Or how the samurai functioned in society differed and evolved over time, right? So if you're going to do Japan, and we're going to do a whole episode on homebrewing Asia, fantasy Japan, we're going to learn more about that there. But yeah, that's my roundabout answer to that question. I know, Jeremy, you were going to say something.
I was just saying, you know, people are always talking about, I want to make fantasy China, fantasy Japan, whatever. Just start even smaller. Like we talked about making an NPC, that's Bruce Lee. Like if you're designing a setting for your game, look at examples in mythology, and maybe there's like a Chinese mythological deity that you feel drawn to. Start with that. Like just make a deity in your game or a small group of people that might worship this individual and explore that. For example, if I wanted to if I wanted to represent Mazu, like the Chinese god of the sea, like and like throw influence from like how people worship her in Taiwan into my fantasy game, I would, you know, start with, you know, how do people on the sea, you know, visit temples and, you know, mazu, like in Chinese culture, how do they like burn incense and how do they worship this deity? How might sailors, you know, pray to her when they're on a difficult voyage? Start with those little questions. Then eventually, once you go from there, pretty soon you'll have an entire, you know, village that worships this goddess of the sea. And you can explore how to represent, you know, those Chinese connections in the span of like a couple people and a couple villagers, and then a tradition of sailing. And then all of a sudden you've got a very fleshed out segment that you could easily interject into like
your pirate campaign or any campaign that takes place.
It's a micro setting.
Yeah,
it's a micro setting.
Yeah,
start small.
Start small and then slowly flesh out. You guys said it on a previous episode of Asians
Represent. The OSR episode.
OSR episode. Actually, I think it might have been another one, but you said, Daniel, start by building a city. Like,
a village or something like that.
Don't try to remake Karator. Just make a city or even a village or a town or a neighborhood.
I had a cool idea, actually, when you were talking about this, like, you know, sea god worshiping like village, and you were like, well, how do they burn incense, or what do they do, where are their shrines? The first idea that popped into my mind, and I might incorporate this into my stuff, I don't know, is what if their shrines or places of worship were dependent on the tides? Mm-hmm. And so when the tides receded, they would actually be able to go and worship. And your adventure hook is the tides haven't receded in however many months, and they can't go and bring an offering to the god. And there is something that is preventing the tides from receding, and the villagers fear that the god will think they have forsaken her.
This also gives you a really easy point to start researching. If you're not familiar,
super easy.
Yeah, you just look up Mazu or any other, we're talking about her, but any other goddess, or you know, you could use a mythological monster or something like that. And you could go from there. It's an easy point to start fleshing out your fantasy China or any fantasy setting with authenticity, with humanity, and also with care. Because
this is literally, I just realized this. I don't know if you were going to say this, Agatha. This is literally how we did the redacted project.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's
based
true.
On the seed.
It is.
Based on the seed.
Yeah. And it's so much easier than just immediately trying to jump in and make your, you know, fantasy version of Japan with samurai. I mean, if you want to do something with samurai, you know, hone it, like start with the idea of start with a single samurai NPC. What does it mean to be a warrior serving in this feudal system? Like, well, what does that actually mean? Start small.
I have a cool one actually that's related to Japan, and I want to hear more from Agatha, but I got to talk about this now because it relates to this particular point in the conversation. There's an anime out now, an anime adaptation now, but Hell's Paradise. Mm. I don't know if any of you have heard of this or read it or watched the anime yet, but one of my favorite manga series of all time. And the reason why is not only is it beautifully illustrated and the story is very cool, but it's rooted in both the Japanese and Chinese perceptions of one mythological location, which I think is very cool. In it, there's like the Penglai, like the immortal mountains in Chinese mythology. Like there's a series of islands, and it's where all these like demigods essentially live. And it's literally about a group of death row convicts from Japan who are sent to this island to try to find what is the elixir of life. And when they go to the island, they realize that it's inhabited by all of these Taoist hermits who are studying immortality and have a Chinese master from the time of the Qin dynasty who was sent out by the first emperor to search for immortality. And it's this really cool story about how these Japanese characters are perceiving of a land that is not only in Japanese mythology, but also Chinese mythology, and how they encounter Chinese characters and are forced to essentially examine different perspectives of like, Tao. Very, very cool from a world building perspective, because this is this blending of cultures in a very respectful way and in a way that makes sense, which you do not see in a lot of RPGs, because like we've talked about earlier, they focus on the sort of Western white perspective, right? They focus on one perspective, which makes everything else foreign and exotic. And they don't actually go and try to view a culture or a source of inspiration from the perspective of the actual local or the perspective of that person's culture, which is why I think Hell's Paradise succeeds so much, and where books like Oriental Adventures and Karator fail, because they are written from this white perspective and this habit of whiteness, and inserting whiteness not in like representation, but white perspective over Asia, not an Asian perspective.
One of the comments in the chat is, I think it's great. It's from Saracenian. Sorry if I'm
great, great artist.
Sorry if I'm not pronouncing that right. But I love what they said, which is that the way to add a way of adding authenticity is to read stories by the cultures and people who made it and learn the tropes and archetypes and how they interact with each other in practice. I really like that because there are certain aspects of a culture that you don't really notice until you read their stories and the way that they kind of just they established a norm or like a normal way of being that you can't know until you see it in action.
100%.
I kind of want to circle back to specifically like China or like fantasy China. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we think are some great cultural touchstones, I guess, is a way to put it, that like is more particular, like particularly Chinese?
Oh, yeah. We did like a whole episode on this, like episode 37 on face. Right. The I mean, honor is a really good example, like to go to the comment from our chat. Like, yeah, it's important to kind of see how cultural elements interact in practice, because if you're looking at it from like a very surface level, when you think about face, you're like, oh, it's like honor. And then that's where you bring in samurai and these like Western perspectives of honor. But when you kind of dive deeper and understand how, you know, families are structured in China and how people use these sort of unwritten rules of a face to interact with one another on a social level, but also on like an economic and material level, you get something far more interesting. And like the concept of face, like mianzi, is like unique to China. There really isn't anything like that in the way it's woven into daily life and social interaction. There really isn't like that anywhere else in the world.
I just feel like there are a lot of equivalents that are like they are.
But that
different.
Triad, but that triad of perception, soliciting power, but also showing power and owing power to others.
Right.
Like there are ways of aggrandizing wealth and showing social power. We see it in a lot of like indigenous cultures here. But the way it's codified in China is really unique. Like how strongly it's codified.
Yeah. The concept of mianzi as a currency, a social currency.
Yes, as a currency.
I feel like that's one of the things that is, yeah, would be good to include if you feel like you have a good grasp of it. Because it is, like, it's hard even for us to explain, so I can understand if it's hard to understand, like, from an outside perspective. But, yeah, that, I think, is one of the things that I would include in a
fantasy. What about food?
China. Yeah.
Yeah, what about food? Like, Jeremy, your point of, like, starting small, and Agatha, your point of, like, finding something you can relate to. Have you ever just gone to a restaurant and, eaten a dish that just changed your life? That was like, this is so different from anything else I've ever eaten. Like, I think that is a really great gateway into China for people when you think about food. Because not only, and this, there was actually a question here from one of our patrons. Like, well, one is like most honorable asked, like with a joke question, will the noodle recipe use more ingredients than Caratour noodles? But in their serious question, in your eyes, what role does food play in homebrewing a fantasy setting? And to Jeremy's initial point, food could literally be your starting point, right? Because the ingredients you use dictate the geography, or it could dictate your trade relationships with others. Like, food also has symbolic meaning. The dishes that you use, the cutlery that you use, how you, like, you know, if you're Chinese and you have your bowl of rice, you don't stick your chopsticks in the rice. right? Because it looks like incense, and it's like, oh, it's associated with death. There's a lot you can do with food if you just start there.
I think how you describe food is very interesting. I mean, in a lot of games that I've run of D&D and Pathfinder, I have a habit of saying that potions of healing taste sort of like, what's it called? Pipa gao, the Chinese medicine that tastes like cough syrup. Yeah. Well, only when I'm around Asian people who know what it is, I tend to revert to that description. When I'm around people that don't know what it is, I usually relate it to something else. I say it tastes like Pepto-Bismol or something. But there I am kind of characterizing a common, you know, beverage and trying to bring out a sensation of what the flavor might be, what the sensation of drinking it might be like for someone. And you can do that with all sorts of food, because that's an easy way to evoke that humanity and that authenticity that we talk about. I mean, if you're going to have your characters sit down to eat something like dim sum is like a four-hour thing in parts of China, go through the motions of describing what each dish is, and the four senses, the smell, the taste, the feel, the texture, and talk about, you know, how these things might influence your playable characters at the gaming table. And if you're going to be developing rules based around food and mechanics, you know, I think all games should probably have mechanics based around food because it's just fun, then that's something to think about, you know. And any kid that's had to drink, you know, pipa gao as a child, you know, and kind of gags at the taste of it, knows that your parents tell you it's really good for you, and it'll cure your cough, but it doesn't go down smooth. So maybe you want to make something that tastes like that, and cures some condition your character might have, but also inflicts some other sort of condition.
It's like
condition.
A really powerful healing potion, but you have to roll like a save.
Yeah, but you got
to
roll.
Like,
you have to roll something, and if you don't, then you're sickened, and you have this feeling of revulsion that sticks with you every time you drink it in the future. So yeah, just as we talked about, starting small with a village, or starting small with a deity, or a monster, start small with a food that you're really interested in. If you want to put char siu fan in your game, investigate the history of char siu fan, and like, what does it mean to have this pork that, you know, is eaten on top of rice? You know, what does it mean to the person who makes it? What does it mean to the person who eats it? The NPC that eats it at the table. Why does this NPC that, you know, has come back from a war, aka like Daniel, why does he want to eat char siu fan? This is first meal.
Yeah I love that.
Yeah, and I mean,
and yeah, like that also really goes into like why is it prepared this way, like what is this kind of like the way that it's preserved in this time, that like what kind of spices did they have available in order to preserve it that way. Like that's all super interesting. I also feel like just in general having food be a focus when you're talking about fantasy China is great, because I think there is like there's a sense of like national pride in how obsessed Chinese people are with food that I have observed online, and the things that I've read, like this is a part of like at least the modern Chinese identity. So I feel like that in general, if you want to talk about evoking China in your fantasy world building, I think food is a great idea outside of all of the other like really evocative like starting points, and also the way that you can relate, because everyone needs to eat, so food,
it's also like deeply like experiential. Like you can, if you start with food, you could literally, your research could be you and your like table, or you and the team of writers go out and just have a meal.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Y'all are making me hungry.
Have a meal.
I played a Call of Cthulhu character named Benny Wong, who grew up in racist 1920s Boston Chinatown and was like solving Cthulhu mysteries with his white friends who were pretty racist towards him. But he would he worked at a Chinese restaurant, and his little sister would always make bao for everyone, and so you'd have this like party like fighting eldritch monsters, but everybody would be eating bao afterwards to relax, and it just became a thing after every single mission, and it added such. That was the mode of relaxation for the group. Nice. Of investigators, and it added such a powerful moment when, in order to like calm down another character, my player Benny, he pulls out a bao and it's like, here, take this, it'll calm you down.
Just eat it.
And I think those moments are easy ones to replicate when you focus on something like food.
100%. Like I played at the start of the pandemic, I played D&D for the first time with my family. And my mom, when we played the Frozen Sick, the Wildmount adventure, and my mom played a cleric. And I asked, like, when she wanted to heal, I was like, how do you do it? And she's like, I pull up my pot and I start making congee. And this one has goji berries in it because it has all this, like, good stuff in it. I was like, cool. Then that became her thing. She literally just became the Asian mom who just cooked for everyone to heal them. And even though they weren't in, like, a fantasy Asia, my mom basically brought, like, our culture into her character. And it was, like, super cute. But I think food, just, like, on a... if we're going to talk about world building, is so important, because if you look at China has these, like, these eight really distinct culinary traditions. And each one has its own sort of, like, palate, but also has its own key ingredients. Some are, like, seafood-based. Like, if you think about the kinds of Chinese foods that are really common in North America, you think about, like, you know, Guangdong, like, Cantonese cuisine, right? And it's the Chinese food that most people know in North America. But there are so many others. If you go to, like, Sichuan, and it's like that numbing spice, right? It's so different. And the idea of, like, oh, I'm going to, the experience of eating is associated with this sort of tingling sensation. And that itself could be magical. But also, if that you're going to center your cuisine around that, we have to think, well, how are the people growing these peppers? And in your fantasy world, are these peppers a high value material? Are they like a currency, you know, in a sense? Are they coveted? Are there different kinds of peppers? Are there literally like pepper lords who own these like pepper plantations and they grow the best pepper, the best numbing sensation? Like, are the chefs in your land regarded above the swordsmiths in my land? I think that could be super interesting. But also, even at its simplest level, the idea of rice, right? When people think of Chinese food, what do they think of? They think of noodles and they think of rice. But historically, not all Chinese people ate rice, right? Rice can only grow in certain parts of China. And in the north, there's this Lus Plateau where rice can't grow and they farm millet instead. And so their cuisine is different. Their agriculture is different. They don't have rice paddies. So now we're thinking about the visual of this village. We understand the food that they eat. We understand maybe there are certain social dynamics associated with certain ingredients. And now we have a visual of what their farming techniques look like, right? Do they have rice paddies, or are they farming on the plateau for these cereal grains? And I think that, to both of your points, is a really interesting way of building out the details, right? We talked about what the people eat and what you might be eating with your friends or coworkers on a project. Now we're talking about what are the ingredients and what are the maybe the social dynamics associated with these ingredients. And then if all these ingredients are produced locally, what does that look like? And I think you immediately have an entire micro setting. What if these peppers are so volatile that it takes a certain degree of skill to harvest them, or a certain tool? Well, now you have somebody who manufactures them. And maybe there is a certain material or a certain type of metal or a certain type of magic that is required to even harvest these things. And now we're just building up on this setting in a really easy way that is honestly just making us all really hungry. And I'm just really hungry.
I think
I'm hungry now too.
I think talking about food really hits home the fact that China is just so big. I mean, it's so much bigger than what a lot of people in North America and Western Europe might think of. You know, you have from Xinjiang to like Harbin to you know, Guangdong. It's cuisines are entirely different, and that kind of takes me to another thing I like to harp on when delving into a fantasy setting influenced by China. I like to delve on the idea of language and the difference in dialects of Chinese, because, you know, only recently was there like a you know, Putonghua, like Mandarin Chinese, the sort of lingua franca that people use to speak with each other. And it's very interesting to delve into the history of language and to explore that from the same perspective that we use to explore food and that we use to explore, like, mythology. You know, maybe people in the north, in your fantasy setting, maybe they speak with, you know, the harsh tones of, like, that might be reminiscent to, you know, someone from northern China or something like that. Maybe people in the south, they have retroflexes that are similar to folks from Taiwan, you know. If you're playing with a group of Chinese people, you can do fun things like that, which is, you know, what we sort of do in our Pathfinder game, Daniel, but you can play with...
Our Pathfinder game could never be streamed.
It could never be streamed. You can play with interesting ideas in language, like, why do people in the South, why do they say zi-zi-si? Why can't they say zhi-zhi-shi? You know, why, you know, how did language evolve over time, and are, you know, can one person be understood by another? How would a conversation between two NPCs play out? And even if, you know, you don't speak Chinese or aren't familiar with Chinese, you can still understand the concept of dialects and accents. What does a different accent represent in the eyes of one character versus another? What does the so-called educated person sound like versus someone who comes from, you know, a countryside rural setting? And once you start tackling those questions, you can build a more fleshed out world, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's something that I personally would avoid because my Chinese is so bad. I would feel like I am producing something inauthentic.
Well, and also, how does a member of the diaspora, like a non-player character or a player character who is entering into this fantasy version of China, how might they communicate? Maybe they speak a form of the language that sounds a little old because they learned it from their grandparents. And their intonations or their expressions are a little bit out of date. How might a shopkeeper react to you going in and speaking the native language when you speak it and your character is like, what, in their 20s, but you speak it like a 70-year-old? That's a very great, fun example for role-playing right there. Maybe they'll give you a discount because they remind you of their grandparents.
I think this really also goes into how you are portraying your NPCs, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you think about how NPCs are portrayed in D&D, it's like, okay, here's their stats and a little bit of a description of them and their abilities. It's really mechanically focused, right? There is narrative. But I wonder if you were to do a Chinese campaign setting, what elements, like non-mechanical elements, would you communicate to the reader about an NPC?
For me it would be language. Like, I would break it down into, like, what sort of dialects do they speak, and I would have a page of lore being like, what do these dialects, you know, where are they spoken, what's the history behind them, what might,
so how each NPC would have like a dialect, like a field,
yeah, like a dialect. like a field for dialect, or are they able to communicate in the, you know, the common tongue that RPGs so often like to put as an easy way to say, oh, your character can talk with this. Like, language is very underplayed in most role playing.
So you'd
games.
Go in like the nitty gritties of like different dialects.
I probably
for
would.
These
yeah,
NPCs.
I probably,
so that's one thing.
I probably do that personally.
What about you, Agatha? What would you put in like a narrative detail for an NPC if you were to do a Chinese campaign setting?
I'm not sure yet. Come back to me. What about you?
yeah, totally. So this is something that I've like slowly working on. So I have a format for NPCs. I don't like to put stats because I don't track HP. I don't like to put stats, but what I put is I use appearance, voice, morality, motivations, and secrets. Mm-hmm. That's what I put for all of my NPCs. So any NPC that I put effort into actually writing up has details on all of them for all of those fields. But if I were to make something like Chinese, for me, because I would feel, I wouldn't say uncomfortable, but less confident in writing like the lore page and all the dialects in their voice or how they would speak, I would write about, you know, they speak with like a country accent, but they live in a city, or they use a lot of slang. And I would kind of bring my own experiences with Chinese, having like studied like Mandarin, going to Beijing and being like, oh, I'm good here. And then going anywhere else and being like, I don't know what you're saying. And kind of making that more, I guess, less, I don't want to say crunchy. Like, I don't think your answer is crunchy, Jeremy.
I would say my answer's not crunchy.
Leave room for more interpretation to a non-Chinese speaker.
I mean, I think one way to go is full-on crunch, which could be fun. Like, I would appreciate that. But I think at least, you know, detailing, you know, some of the flares of, for example, certain dialects and some of the regions where they might be spoken is a good way to start. You know, it's a good way to instantly ingratiate groups of NPCs with player characters who might speak those same dialects. Like if
keywords for dialects, so you could be like the tone of this dialect versus like, you know,
exactly.
You could be like, this one is more aggressive or this, they speak faster.
This leads to very interesting interactions. I mean, when I first learned Chinese, I primarily learned at university. So I had the accent of like a Beijinger, like a northerner. And then when I went to Taiwan and had to do a visa run, I got my visa in Singapore, and the lady asked me why I spoke like I was from the mainland. And that's always a back and forth question, a back and forth interaction you have to make when you end up explaining your own history just through these interactions that display how you talk.
Yeah.
I really like
that. Do you have an answer yet, Agatha?
I do really like the dialect detail. I think, like, I want to, like, second that as a cool idea. I think another background detail that I would include is, like, family situation. For example, like, Are they married or unmarried? Do they come, like, are they orphaned, or like what kind of a family background they have? Is their father dead? Like that kind of a thing, because that affects so many different aspects of, you know, a person's life.
I like that. What would be the one word that you would use? Would it be like family status? Would it be position in the family?
I would put familial situation, or like family situation, or something like that. That's not a great word, but I would go along.
It's a tough one. I get what you're saying, though. But you're so it would be because I think we should come up with this right here, right? Because this is something that we could use for the stuff that we're going to do. Ancients represent, right?
Yeah.
So we have dialect. Like, if we do Wandering Blades, we should 100% start doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
So we have dialect. We have, honestly, like, it could be family relationships. What do you think about that?
I feel like family relationships imply that it's, like, it's talking more about, like, oh, like, I'm closer with my brother than my sister, you know? Mm. But this is more like, what is your... I guess maybe family background, is that?
Aizen in the chat mentioned, because we're talking about Confucianism, and said familial standing is a suggestion.
Ooh, I think
like you might need some context, you know, on family structure in your setting and what things are. Or what things are expected among certain families. But I think it's very interesting to delve into that. Does a person, you know, has a person rejected, you know, their family because they didn't necessarily, you know, like many Chinese children did not agree with their parents. That's a very interesting plot point right there.
Yeah. Or if like familial standing is like, oh, like sent to their aunt and uncle's place because their parents couldn't afford to raise them. That's like a very interesting thing. It, like you immediately know a lot about, or you can start thinking about how they may act or like the things that they may care about just based on
gender. I would put first son.
Yeah.
I would put this. Here's what I would put: level of generational trauma. Like that's what I would put.
So there's a game. So there's actually a game that already kind of does something like this, but it's not Asian. It's called Harn Master. It's a really, really cool RPG, but a part of character creation. There are a ton of optional rules. Like you could roll to be like, STIs do I have?
I remember you telling me about this thing.
What STIs do I have? And all this weird stuff. But there is a part where you actually determine your birth attributes. Mm-hmm. Not only do you determine like your culture is codified in this. So you have a culture, they do have species, you have a birth date, your sign, like your zodiac. Like that could be cool depending on
Zodiac,
like,
Zodiac might be interesting.
Zodiac would be cool. I think that'd be neat.
And blood type, if like, we want to go in that direction. I mean, Japan always lists blood type. Japan and Korea, lots of importance on blood type if you want to get into that.
So I think like star sign, mm-hmm. or I guess that's not star sign, wouldn't be a pro. I would think Zodiac sign.
I don't or get something the equivalent. Zodiac thing. Because like Zodiac is by year.
I'm thinking of Agatha is I'm not thinking so much of Zodiac necessarily. What I had in my mind is, you know, when they analyze the characters of your Chinese name along with the time when you were born and then tell you basically your personality traits.
Your personality?
What is that
but
called?
Yeah,
what,
but
what,
those
what's,
are the,
what's
those
that called
are the,
in Chinese? I forget.
I'm looking for the, looking into the chat.
It's, are you talking
Eisen,
about like
Eisen,
your
help
bots?
Us out.
Like your,
yeah, bots. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Birth pillars.
Birth
is that?
Pillars. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Zodiac
is sort of like a fraction of that. Like if you correspond it with like the star signs. But basically where they take the characters in your name and they take the time you were born and they ask you a bunch of questions and they compare this information with information that's been collected throughout history and then sort of tell you the general trends of what your personality is and essentially what your future is. It's a kind of fortune telling, but it's so in-depth
and
like so interesting.
Pillars of Destiny.
Yeah, Pillars
Ooh,
of the
Destiny.
That is such a good name. Pillars of Destiny.
Oh
that,
my goodness.
Oh, that could be... Right there.
Oh,
let's
that
trademark
great,
that. Yeah. TTRPG
Liana,
right
Valorous Games. Let's do it.
Pillars of Destiny.
Oh my
Pillars of Destiny.
A Chinese-themed TTRPG.
But then I would also add in, so in Harn Master, another thing they do is there's literally a family development. So you roll for your sibling rank, your parental relationship. So you could be like, I roll and I am literally the youngest child, or I can be like, I am fostered. You can even roll to the degree of estrangement you are from your family in Harn Master. It's like, it's a lot of crunch. But there are games that think about this, but they're not necessarily Chinese. So right now we have dialect, familial standing, pillar of destiny. God, that's cool.
So cool. I love that name.
I honestly feel like... what else would we add? I don't want to do like... You could literally do like rank in society.
Well, you could also just do name, like related to pillars of death, or birth pillars. You could just do the name. Like if you have if a character's name,
and
like,
you just have a little table.
Yeah.
What
might their name represent? I mean, the if you're dealing with Chinese characters, like why did your parents give you this name, or why did you choose this name for yourself? Like my mom has a Chinese name that is decidedly quote-unquote unfeminine because her father did not want daughters. He wanted sons, and he named all of the girls in the family very masculine names to represent this, for better or for worse. So when people hear my mother's name, they're like, oh, that's interesting. It stands out in their mind. But there you go. That's an interesting flair you could insert into your game.
I would have to look into this more, but I know that within Chinese families, there is a naming pattern, like mm-hmm. a convention. I feel like that could be something you could work into it.
Or if you're like a diaspora person, like do you have a foreign name that's been transliterated and somehow sounds different? Like if you take Jeremy and make it Jeremy or something like that, like you know that sounds a little funny, but it's a name. What does that mean? What are the connotations? You know, my name is not Jeremy. It's
so we've got three things. So let's say the person is looking at the book of whatever RPG it is, Wandering Blades, whatever it is, and they see, okay, these are my characters. This NPC, they have a dialect, a familial standing, a pillar of destiny. Is there anything else that we would want to communicate to the reader, to the GM, so that they can then roleplay this character? We have how they sound, right? Because we've talked about their dialect and how that can be codified in the game, in like even using keywords. You could be like, this dialect has these keywords, right? To kind of as a quick reference. We have their familial standing to talk about their relationship within their family and society in general, right? We have their pillar of destiny, which is more spiritual, right? And related to divination. But what else would be needed to help the gameplay experience and make it more Chinese?
Oh, I felt like I would just put, like, in general, for NPC creation, I would put, like, what do they want and why can't they get it? Just...
Yeah, like, needs, that sort of thing, like, that generic stuff.
Yeah, but...
Favorite food.
I don't know, like, I mean, this is not really Chinese, but I always like it when in like fighting games, when they're introducing a character and they always have like hobbies, like in Street Fighter.
Yeah, that's what I was going with. Favorite foods
in Street Fighter 6. Hobbies. Like, what's the hobby of like the new Chinese dude, Jamie? It's like, isn't it like drunken kung fu or something like that, or like b-boying or something? Like, yeah, it's,
you
like,
know,
that's
what
fun.
Would you know? What'd be cool. So I've recently started doing a family history with my dad.
Yeah, his Jamie, the new Chinese character in Street Fighter 6. His hobbies are, well, there are two other characters. They use hates and likes. He hates getting hates getting lectured, and he hates arrogance, which is interesting. He likes Yun and Yang, who are two other characters. He likes dancing and his grandmother.
Oh,
so that's very interesting.
I like hates and
likes.
Like, cool.
He's like a, you know, he's like a drunken kung fu b-boy, and it's very interesting. We already know that he has a connection with his grandfather. He has a connection with two other characters in the lore who are like established martial artists. And he hates getting lectured, and he hates arrogance. So we have very simple character traits boiled down to a few words.
I thought of another one, and like Nykstem mentioned family nickname in the chat. I've been doing this, like, I made a family database, and I'm going through like our like traditional Chinese like family tree with my dad and my grandpa, getting everything translated. It's really cool. But one thing I learned is that, you know, you have a birth name, a working name, and a married name. Mm-hmm. And so NPCs in this world might have multiple names. And I think that could be something very interesting. Because then you could have other NPCs address them differently, and have the players kind of see how this works. And if you're a player, maybe you have multiple names too.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was mentioned, I don't remember who mentioned it in the chat. It was Lychee Musings. Like in the Han through Six Dynasties, there's the Zi, which is like, that's the name. I don't remember how it works anymore. Like, it's the name that your friends would call you versus like your actual like official name. Like, you could also just have something like that, like the name that those who are close to you would call you. I guess like a nickname, but it's not a nickname because it's more official than
quite
that.
A nickname.
So
yeah, it could be a you have to find a word to describe a nickname, but only to those who are close to you, like a codified nickname. But that is also something that is like sort of like associated with Chinese culture. I think we'd also do our audience a disservice if we didn't talk about resources, because I think we could probably go all day talking about this stuff. And I'm very curious to see where this will go with the next one, because I think we have a format, right? This one very much talked about, you know, the overarching themes of like, we want to break away from this habit of whiteness, right? We talked about food, right? We talked about language. And I think framing it around like an NPC is really interesting, and how an NPC would be basically presented to the reader or to the audience. I would love to know, because we talked about, you know, really writing about what you know. But what if somebody goes and answers the question of, this is why I want to use China as my source of inspiration, and they're not Chinese. And they think about, okay, well, what is my entry point? Maybe it is food. Maybe it isn't. Maybe they've found something like the state exams, Agatha, like that you mentioned, that is something they can relate to. And now they want to build off of that. Where can they go for research? What are some sources of inspiration that you would recommend? Like, you two would recommend?
Wikipedia, bro.
Wikipedia.
It's a great starting point.
It is a great starting point. I completely agree.
I mean, I always think that it's good to delve into resources that were written by the or created by the people of that culture. don't necessarily delve into just, you know, like the stuff written by like the white guys who, the China watchers who have studied China. Like if you're creating monsters influenced by China, then take a look at the Classic of Mountain and Seas, which I know Daniel is a massive fan of. Like that's essentially a Chinese bestiary. The Shanghai Jing. Yeah, there you go. That is it. Literally called a Chinese bestiary. Incredibly weird book. Just literally listing off the names of places and the strange monsters that dwell in these places.
I just opened it up. We have the people with crossed shins. Mm-hmm. The land of the people with crossed shins lies farther east of the land of the people with perforated chests. Mm-hmm. The people have crossed shins. That's it.
There's so much in there that can be used as inspiration. So I think going to these primary sources, whether they're mythology, whether they're sort of like quasi-historical texts like the Shanghai Jing is very valuable. Or you could start with, you know, you could start with the Chinese classics, like, you know, The Journey to the West, Romance of the Three Kingdoms, Dream of the Red Chamber. Those are great places to start. You don't have to go as far back as that, but if you are interested in, for example, China, and your only reference is, I don't know, why would someone be interested in China?
Food, maybe wuxia.
Yeah. I would encourage you guys to go a little bit further back and to delve into, okay, what are the connotations of wuxia? Where did wuxia come from? Where did this idea, this image of like the Chinese fantasy first stem from? And then kind of investigate the sources that have influenced it. Similar to how we all understand that, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons is influenced by a variety of things. You know, Tolkien, pulp fantasy, you know, the myths of Western Europe, Conan, King Arthur stories, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Aizen mentioned in the chat that another Chinese bestiary could be Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio, which is more...
I was literally just about to mention that. It's so cool. And you can find all of the stories translated in English for free on Gutenberg. Because mm-hmm. It's an anthology of weird tales. Some of them are like only a paragraph from the Qing Dynasty. It's super cool and really weird. There's like one of the stories is about like body parts falling from the sky. Another is about like body parts showing up in the walls of an inn.
Yeah, I love that one.
And these travelers get all like, oh, what the fuck? And they start stabbing them and they just basically get like, I think they get like charged for murder or something. But they have these like weird supernatural encounters that don't often have a resolution. Very interesting stuff. Yeah, that's another one I would recommend. Honestly, if you like supernatural stuff, I would go like Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio. I would go with the Shanghai Jing because there's just so much strange and interesting stuff there that you could just make as part of the truth of the world. I would also, honestly, I like how Agatha said Wikipedia, because when you go to Wikipedia, I love to go and look at the references at the bottom, because you can often find scholarly resources. Now, not everyone has access to like a university or college library to get your scholarly resources for free, but you can often find the authors. And as a former scholar who has published scholarly resources, scholars don't get paid for that. Like if you go and publish in a scientific journal, like I have a couple of times, I didn't get paid for that. I had to pay to do it. And people love it when you reach out and show genuine interest in their work. And for me, when I was doing research on the Yue state, there aren't a lot of English language resources, particularly around swords. And I found that there was only one scholar who had done work on it, and her entire dissertation was on translating basically the period history book on the Yue. And she wrote a whole chapter about the swords. And the book was like 200 USD if I wanted to get a print copy of her thesis. So I emailed her, Dr. Olivia Milburn, and I said, I'm doing this research on this project. It's for a game, and your research came up in my preliminary sort of search. And she was over the moon and sent me a PDF of all the resources I needed for free. And scholars are very, very keen on doing that, as long as you're respectful and you're showing interest in their work. I also would say, you know, a lot of museums have free resources on material culture. So the Met has a free visual database that you can go to find a lot of information and provenance data on objects. Many museums also publish these. My favorite is actually the Royal Armouries in the UK. The Royal Armouries, they have a beautiful website where you could also buy the rights to publish their photos in your publications as well of their artifacts. So if you ever want to do like a weapon guide or something, you can go to the Royal Armouries and get a license for them. They also publish books, and they have like arms and armor series for like all over the world. And I got this for like 10 bucks. And it's literally Chinese arms and armor by the Royal Armouries. And it's written by their scholars. And it's got all beautiful pictures and context about Chinese arms and armor through time. Another one, this is from University Press. So many universities have like big Ivy League schools and other like high profile institutions have their own publishing houses. And Cambridge University Press had one on Chinese clothing. And it's literally the history of Chinese clothing based on, you know, art, surviving materials. But also what I think is interesting is that they talk about the different cultures within China and their different forms of dress. There's like an entire section on the history of how makeup is applied throughout the different dynasties, or how different types of undergarments evolved throughout time. Is really, really cool, especially if you want to, if you have an idea of what your setting looks like based on maybe the tropes that you are used to. Going to resources like this, like these sort of comprehensive entry-level resources that kind of look at the entire history of a culture or region, are really great for kind of uncovering your biases and identifying what is actually more authentic, with air quotes. Those are the books that I brought out. Chinese clothing, Chinese arms and armor, and the Shanghai Jing. Do you folks have anything else? What about food? What would be the best resource on food?
Honestly, I would just Google So the way that I have done research personally about like Chinese culture to put in the game, the redacted project that we worked on is I think I first went to Wikipedia, and then, well, I have the advantage of knowing how to read Chinese, and I recognize that a lot of sources are just more readily available in Chinese if you're looking into the culture, but like I found a lot of times what I did was I would look at sometimes they'll include like the Chinese characters for certain things, and then I would like copy and paste that. And I've done this for research into other other cultures with languages that I don't read. And I would like Google things related to that and then Google Translate. So for example, like with food, like if you Google Translate, like one of the main, what was it, like 8 cuisines, you can Google
the 8
that.
Culinary traditions.
Sometimes there are English like sites, but sometimes there are sites that are in Chinese. And then, you know, now with Google Translate being so readily available, I would also look at that. That's how I went about it for myself.
Yeah. There was also in the chat, Aizen mentioned A Bite of China, the food documentary.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
There's one on Netflix if you folks still have a Netflix account. I don't.
Is A Bite of China, where do you watch that now? I don't know
where you can watch that one now, but there was one on a series called Flavorful Origins that was on Netflix that was really good because it went into very obscure, at least from a Western perspective, obscure cuisines, and talked about how a particular dish or a particular ingredient, because each episode is an ingredient, impacts the daily life of people in these small locations. Like there's a whole episode on mutton and all the different dishes. It was a really cool series. Really cool series. For both of them, like folks in the chat have said, do not watch them on an empty stomach because they're real good. I would say this is perhaps a radical one, But Anthony Bourdain's TV series are probably the best example of how a non-Asian person can go to Asia and learn about the culture. Because he always approached everything from the lens of food, and he was never afraid to eat something, which I think is really important, especially around tropes around like food. Because, you know, we talked when we were talking about like Neon Dynasty Kamigawa and how there's that card, Dockside Chef, and that perpetuates this stereotype that Chinese food is gross and exotic and unpalatable. But folks like Anthony Bourdain went and ate everything and tried to understand them from the perspective of the chef, which I think is really important. Especially if you're not Chinese and you're trying to understand how you can best approach it.
I have not seen that card before. Wow.
Okay, yeah, it was really bad, right?
I mean, it's really bad. I just saw the eyeball in the bowl of noodles, yeah.
And look at the, I mean, it's like the flavor text too.
Yeah.
You know it's good if it's moving or something like that. And if you think about the mechanics surrounding it and everything, it's disappointing, especially since Watsi was really like, cultural consultants! And it's another example of why, you know, cultural consultants aren't the end-all be-all, because they could do a lot of fantastic work, but they might not even have seen that card, right? And this is where, you know, research is so important. But that said, we also have one last thing to talk about. And the last thing we have to talk about are our amazing patrons. We have a lot of people who, you know, make Asians represent a reality. You're the reason why we can, we're going to be able to upgrade all of our gear. The reason why we'll be able to get like a new webcam for Jeremy and Agatha, a new mic if needed for Jeremy and Agatha and everybody else on the team. If we need lights, if, you know, we need, you know, designs for merch, we actually have the ability to do that now. And I'm really happy because some of our patrons are finally getting some of the merch that we sent them, and they're getting our Bubble Tea Book Club dragon stickers now, which is so cool. I'm going to make sure that we keep doing stuff like that. We have a lot of people to thank, especially like our most honorable patrons, Middleweave Games, Andreas, who I think is like a great example of a non-Asian designer who goes and does a lot of research and is like really conscientious about how he interacts with the community and stuff. Obviously, Liana, Valorous Games, who is going to be publishing Wandering Blades. I got to show both of you the logo for Wandering Blades after the stream is done, because we got all the assets in, and I think it looks awesome. Dungeon Glitch / Matt, who is also at D&D Summit with me, does a great job of, you know, trying to bring positivity to the community. Most Honorable times to Epic Impulse, who asked a really great question during the stream. And then, of course, like Michelle, congratulations on your new baby. Stefan, who's going to be on the podcast in the future. Stefan and I had a really great conversation about scholarship in TTRPGs. And there is a thing that I want to do with involve both of you in. And I think it might intrigue you, Agatha, as a story gamer. But I want to try playing what is called a Bronstein. And I'm writing a piece for my Substack. Actually, I'm going to first shout out Bob C, because you're awesome and super honorable too. But I am writing a piece for my Substack called Inventing the Role-Playing Game. It's kind of like a series where I'm trying to dive into the history of RPGs in a more accessible way. And I'm diving into the history of the first GM, or the person who invented the practice of role-playing in tabletop games. And his name is David Wesley. And he created this game called the Bronstein. And it is very, very enigmatic to a lot of people, but he is essentially the first person who created this sort of practice of role-playing, because after him, Dave Arneson, who was a big fan of the Bronsteins, kind of combined it with his like love of chainmail and made Blackmore, which eventually, you know, turned into like his collaboration with Gygax and D&D. But I want to play a Bronstein, and I would like to involve Asians Rep people. in it, because I think it would be a lot of fun. It is not mechanically intense. In fact, like, I'm doing so much research into trying to figure out what the rules are. It's very weird. There are pictures from like old Gen Cons where there are handouts to people and you have secrets and you have to say what your actions are, and everybody has a role in this town. Seems very interesting, and I would love to try playing it with the Agents Represent team. And maybe we'll record it, and our patrons can watch us kind of fumble through what is basically the first TTRPG. That could be really fun. But that said, I just want to thank you two for joining me for episode 69 of Agents Represent. We've got some good episodes ahead of us. We are also, I'm going to put a call out for a guest. Liana is hosting the next episode or the episode after, and we're going to have Pam on as a guest, and it's going to be about Final Fantasy XIV. After all these years of asking me, we're finally doing an episode on Final Fantasy XIV. But we are looking for a guest who is a fan of the game and can speak to the representation of Japanese culture in it. So we can't rely on Emma for this one, because Emma's never played the game. So we're looking for somebody who can speak to that. So if you know someone, or if you are someone who can do this, like if you are Japanese, please get in touch with a member of the Agents Represent team, preferably like myself or Liana, for this episode. Really excited. And if you think that you'd be a really good guest for a future of Asians Represent, if you want to do an episode of Homebrewing Asia and you really liked this and you want to talk about your culture and how it can be represented on the tabletop or in a product, let us know. If you're a member of our Discord community, please reach out to like one of us. We'd love to know. We'd love to help you out. We'd love to help you share your stories with, you know, the world. And that's kind of what Asians Represent is all about. And I'm just super grateful that we're back and that the three of us got to do this episode. But that said, take care, everyone. And we'll see you next time on Asians Represent for episode 70, because there will never be another episode 69. Bye, everyone.
The history of role-playing games is weird and wild, and we here at System Mastery are determined to look through it all.
Every heartbreaker that drove a man to bankruptcy to see his vision of D&D with really specific armor maintenance rules come to fruition.
Every game where you get increasingly certain as you read it that this is all just one person's weird fetish.
Every system that painstakingly recreates how medieval life was really like, and then also you can cast Fireball.
The System Mastery podcast wallows in the filth of RPG history. Come!
Join us in the muck
at System Mastery.